Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. Wanted to go over a chart that I think will blow your mind. And I'm not being hyperbolic at all. It may be the best chart I've ever seen. And I look at a lot of charts, as you can imagine. So let's dive into this. And hopefully I can give you the link so you guys can check it out yourself. I think I'm actually going to use it in an upcoming presentation that I'll be doing at Mark Moss's event. Probably do a whiteboard video on it tomorrow as well. I think the main takeaway here is you have to know what you don't know. And when you look at this chart, and I'm going to combine it with a chart of M2 money supply, I think at least I've come to the conclusion that even giving a probability to what is going to happen with inflation is impossible. It's not knowable. And so you can have some guesses here and there, obviously. But again, I don't think it's knowable to the point where I would make an investment decision on it for the next 6 months or a year. I mean, if you want to say 5 years, 10 years, absolutely. I totally get it. Like the long-term super cycle in commodities, that's a completely different thing. When you're trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next 6 months or year or 2 years, even, I don't think it's knowable when it comes to inflation, deflation, disinflation. Here's what I mean. Let's go to the chart here. So investmentoffice.com/observations market history. This is the free digital edition, a visual history of the Federal Reserve System from 1914 to 2009. And you got to read it from left to right and then from right to left like this. They've got this little diagram here. And they give you short summaries on the left of each time period. And then they give you this legend to where that'll help you read all the data that's on the chart. And it's a mind-blowing amount of data. They've even got reverse repos, for heaven's sakes. And then they've got all these lines that's depicted on the chart. You can tell what it is. The main thing that we'll focus on today is just the overall size of the Fed's balance sheets. And then they've got the assets here, the liabilities here. So at the beginning of this cycle from 1936 to 1968, the Fed's balance sheet was under 20 billion with a B. Oh, wow. Crazy, isn't it? But then it grew significantly from 1936 to 1945. It went from, call it maybe 15 billion up to 50 billion, 50. And again, that 50 billion might not seem like a big number compared to the 8 trillion or 9 trillion where we are today. But in terms of a percentage of growth, that is staggering. That would be, I mean, we went from the Fed's balance sheet going from, let's say, 4.5 or 4 to 9 trillion, doubling in the last, we'll call it just 2 years. Okay, well, and that's significant for sure. But my goodness, we're going from, let's just look at this time frame, from 30 to 50. Yeah, I guess even by those standards back then, what we've seen over the last 2 years is quote unquote unprecedented. Yeah. But the change from 1936 to 1945, call it that decade, that's staggering. I don't know if we have seen, in fact, that would be nothing like today, as far as looking at a decade where the Fed's balance sheet increased by that percentage. I mean, we're looking at a let's just call it a 5 times increase. I mean, wow. So what I want to point out first, though, is once we get to 1945, the Fed's balance sheet pretty much doesn't move. It is true that the composition of the asset side of the Fed's balance sheet changed a bit, that we had a little less gold, a little more treasuries. And this would make sense because the U.S. during this time frame had the long end and the short end of the treasury curve pegged. They had it pegged until 1951, where the long end was at 2.5%. So initially, this may not be surprising or may not be interesting, but once you think about it, it really is. And here's why. This green line or dotted line is the CPI. And you can see we went from, and they've even got rates right here, percentages, as if they need more information on this chart. This thing is just unbelievably detailed. It's awesome. So you can see in 1946, and you'll have to bear with me, guys, because I'm trying to see it through my bad eye here, and it's a little difficult. But 1946, CPI around 2% or so. This would make a lot of sense because of this data point. Look at this, from 1942 to, call it, the beginning of 1947, we had wartime price and wage controls in effect. So obviously, it's no surprise that inflation was very low, for consumer price inflation. But then what happened is, as soon as these price controls were released, it's, well, you can predict what happens next. And whenever you have price controls, what happens to the supply of the thing that you're limiting the price of? The supply goes down. So then when you lift those controls, then the price skyrockets higher, which is what we saw in 1947 when the CPI got up to 19.5%. 19.5. So why did this happen? Basically a supply shock, because you had these price controls, and as soon as those price controls were lifted, the demand shot through the roof, and the prices were allowed to go up. Therefore, you have this demand supply-demand imbalance, extreme imbalance. And when the prices are set by the free market, they skyrocket until the prices can go high enough where more supply is brought back online, which brings the prices back down to an equilibrium. And you can see that didn't even come down to an equilibrium. It came down to just before 1950, I think, at the end of 1949, we had almost 3% deflation. Deflation, not disinflation, not the CPI went down by 3%. Prices went down. We had 3% deflation, go from almost 20% on the CPI down to a negative 3 print. Unbelievable. And this happened within the matter of, call it, 2 years or so. So let's remember, though, that the Fed had the yield curve pegged at 2.5%. And that's a big deal, because if you're holding a long bond, think about the purchasing power you're losing. If you're holding it at 2.5% and the CPI goes up 19.5, that's a negative real yield of 17%, negative 17% real yield or interest rates. So why on earth would anyone hold one of those bonds when you're losing that much purchasing power? And it is true, it only lasted for a short time, maybe 2 or 3 years, this massive inflation. But still, when we went back down to negative 3, it's not like it stayed at negative 3 long enough to get prices back to where they were in 1946, let's say. Not even close. So you would have essentially hit a high water mark, let's say, maybe around 1949, the beginning of 1949, and prices did not come down. So you would have just forever lost that much purchasing power relative to the long bonds that you were holding in your portfolio, which, by the way, the government duped you into buying. They called them war bonds or liberty bonds, right? It's this propaganda by the government that they say, oh, buy our bonds. It's the patriotic thing to do. And then what does the government do as soon as the war ends? They just inflate away all your purchasing power and steal, basically tax you. And they dupe you into buying the bonds, and then the bonds have no value. I mean, it's just such a scam from the government. But regardless, I don't want to get off on a tangent. So you would assume that if you were one of these bondholders, I mean, think about that. Let's just say that you own a 30-year treasury that's paying 2.5%, and it's 1947, and headline CPI is 19.5%. What do you do? Well, my guess is you would sell the bond, or you'd get rid of it, or you'd, take it. And remember, the Fed will buy it at the same rate. So you're not losing any capital gain, or you're not having a capital loss, but you're just getting rid of it because your purchasing power is just getting destroyed by inflation. So you would think that literally 100% of the private sector that owned these bonds would have sold them. But if they would have, in order to keep that peg, what would the Fed have had to do? they would have had to buy all those bonds. Did they? Look at their balance sheet right here. Here's the $50 billion mark. So in 1946, their balance sheet was, call it $46 billion. By the end of this inflation, or when they went into deflation, their balance sheet right here was less. Look, this point where my arrow is right here, when we were at 3% deflation, their balance sheet was less then. Now, in the interim, it kind of went up a little bit, but not much. And look at this. And from 47, the amount of gold as a percentage of their assets went up. Therefore, the amount of treasuries went down, because pretty much you've got just treasuries and gold. And I mean, from 47, peak of this inflation, to 50, they were a net seller of treasuries, a net seller. And then remember, in 51, the peg was lifted. So how is this even possible that everyone wasn't selling their bonds and the Fed having to buy them, making their balance sheet look like this? This is the trajectory that their balance sheet should have been on in order to keep this peg when CPI was 19.5%. The only conclusion that I can come to is the market didn't sell the bonds because they saw this coming, because they knew inflation was transitory, let's say. Maybe the market knew inflation was transitory, so they held the bonds. Therefore, the Fed didn't even have to buy them. That's the only conclusion that makes sense to me. Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today. Because again, put yourself in that position as a bondholder, a long-term bondholder. It's got it at 2.5%, and inflation is 19.5. Put yourself in that position, and you think that 19.5 is going to continue on forever. I mean, you would sell immediately, and very few people did. At least large pools of these treasuries. So it now I'd be fascinated, obviously, to go back in time and just try to, you know, go back in time to 1947 to try to get a feel for the mood, the atmosphere. You know, were they saying that inflation was transitory back then? Or was this like the 1970s when they thought that inflation was going to continue to just go up and up and up to infinity and beyond? Buzz Lightyear. It's really a head scratcher. And obviously the reason I'm bringing this up is to try to layer this information over what we have today, because I think too many people make the mistake of simply looking at the 1970s and saying to themselves, oh, this is how inflation plays out. We've seen this movie before. We have seen the inflation movie before, but it was drastically different when you look at the 1940s compared to the 1970s. Now, I am not saying that our situation in the 2020s is identical to the 1940s. That is not what I'm saying. What I am saying, though, is many people assume that we have to take rates positive in real terms in order to ever tame, quote unquote, inflation. And although that may be true, it might not be true because this hasn't always been the case. Now, again, you can argue, oh, George, this time it's different than the 1940s because X, Y, and Z. Fair play to you. All I'm saying is that there has been times in the past when inflation has gone from 20% down to negative 3% when we never had rates even close to positive in real terms. In fact, they're negative 17%. So now this is just, I'm barely scratching the surface of this chart. So definitely check this out when the live stream is done. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on. This chart is just, whoever put this together really did a service, and incredible that this is free on the internet. But now let's, having looked at the huge inflation spike in the 1940s, and it spiked up to 13% too, by the way, in the early 1940s. But now looking at this through the lens of M2 money supply, you know, you always hear that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Milton Friedman teaches us this. And I believe that is true. I mean, it makes a lot of sense when, if you've got X amount of goods and services and Y amount of currency units and the Y doubles, then the price goes up. The price goes up for the X amount of goods and services. But I think there's other factors at play here, and there's so many other factors at play. This is why I come to the conclusion that that what is going to happen in the next 6 months or year is pretty much unknowable. So let's go to this next chart of M2 money supply. So now I wish I had a chart that was, what do they call it, logarithmic or whatever, when you could see the percentage increase, or it's more obvious, let's say between 1968 and 1980, because we'll look at it and like, oh, that didn't even move at all. But if the chart ended in 1980, I think as a percentage of M2 money supply growth, this would be significant. This would have, let's say, gone up by 20, 30, 40, 50% from 1968 to 1980. Although on this chart, it looks like it barely moved at all. So if the if inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, and if our money supply is truly represented well by M2 and M2 alone, how do we explain this? Like, look at what happened from 1992, let's say, to 1995. We pretty much had zero M2 money supply growth. Now, does that mean that the CPI was zero from, let's say, these 3 years? No, absolutely not. I mean, I don't have a chart in front of me, but right off the top of my head, I would say that CPI was probably running at 4 or 5%, something like that. So how does this happen? And then look at 2004 to 2016. We had M2 money supply go from, call it 6 trillion, to 12 trillion, double from 2004 to 2016. Now, did prices of stuff double in the United States? I would be the first person to admit that the CPI drastically understated inflation during that, let's say, decade. But, and there's some prices of some things that definitely doubled. But did everything double? Like, did rent double from 2004 to no. Did housing double? Housing, no, not at all. So there's got to be something more to it. So then you say, okay, George, well, it's not just the supply of money. It's the supply of money relative to goods and services. So you could say that, well, China came online, let's just say in 2004, roughly, you know, right around, let's say here, and they started producing all of these goods and flooded the United States with cheap goods. Therefore, we had more and more and more stuff on the shelves of Walmart, Target, and Home Depot. Therefore, we had so much stuff that even if the money supply doubled, we had double the stuff. Therefore, you wouldn't expect a high degree of inflation. Now, this makes a lot of sense. But then let's go back to the 1970s, and we had massive price inflation there. Now, it is true that we had additional money supply, but I don't know if the money supply grew at the same rate as the CPI, as far as M2. So then you would say, okay, well, maybe that was a supply. So did we have a lot less supply back then? I don't know. Did we have a lot more supply from 1992 to 2004, or maybe from 1992 to 1995, did we have a lot less supply of stuff or the same amount of stuff? Therefore, you see, it starts to kind of fall apart where you're like, okay, well, there's got to be something else. And I think the something else is the money supply, the dollar supply in the euro dollar market that we can't see. So, you know, I would argue, and I think Snyder would argue as well, that in the 1990s, you had significant money supply growth from this period to this period, where it shows very little on the chart, but you had the money supply growth in the euro dollar system. And so if the euro dollar system was going like this, and this is going flat, you can see why, you know, the velocity of money, according to the economists, went up significantly, because obviously GDP went up big time. So if money supply stays the same, GDP goes up, they assume that velocity goes up, but they don't recognize the fact that you've got another source of dollars, the euro dollar system, that is off in the shadows that could have produced a significant amount of dollars that's not represented on this chart, and therefore velocity might have been the same. So how do we figure out what is going on in the euro dollar market? I don't know. I mean, I think there's ways to figure out, you know, maybe the bond market, what it's telling us, and other things that Snyder and Emil talk about. But to really pinpoint it with accuracy, to be able to determine, well, what's going to happen in the next 6 months, year, or 2 years, it's just, again, I don't think it's knowable, because you've got to know also what's going to happen to the supply of stuff. What is going to happen to the supply of stuff? Is it going to increase or decrease? Stay the same? Well, I would argue that it's probably going to decrease, but you don't know that definitively. And then what is going to happen to M2? Well, I would argue it's going to go up. Okay, great. But what happens to euro dollar? Does that go up or down? I don't know. I mean, we've got Russia at war with Ukraine. You've got the United States potentially getting involved. You've got Russia today just turned off the taps to Poland because Poland didn't want to pay for the energy in rubles. And so what does this, and energy is the economy. So if the global economy has access to a lot less energy, and all of that's being funneled basically from Russia to China, what happens to global economic growth? It declines. Okay, well, global economic growth is declining at a substantial rate. What should we expect to happen to the amount of euro dollars, I should say, that are being produced by the global banking system? Most likely goes down. So if you've got this occurring because you've got a global recession, even if you've got the amount of dollars in the United States that's being produced continue to go up at this rate, on net balance, are there more or less dollars? I don't know. And I don't think anybody does. That's my point. And one of the things that made me pretty darn good at making money in business before I retired is I would try to the best of my ability to know what I didn't know. And I think, again, based on these charts, trying to predict the rate of inflation. Now, I think, you know, doing it for a whiteboard video or a thought experiment, or if someone says, George, what's your base case? I can definitely tell them. And I've expressed that to you guys many times. I've gone over that on whiteboard videos. How I think that, you know, CPI in the United States will go up Q2, Q3, something like that. Then it's going to flatten out, decline a little bit. For a variety of reasons. And I think we do get a recession in the United States that brings it down. I don't know if we go to deflation. I don't think so, but we could. I mean, if the stock market goes down by 50% for some black swan event like World War III, yeah, we could definitely see deflation, even with the supply crunch that we have. But I think it would only be very short-lived. I'm not saying we have deflation for the next decade, right? It might be for 2 or 3 months, something like we saw during the GFC, before the Fed and the government start creating new currency units through deficit spending and QE and all the things they do to prop up the economy, prop up the market. And that's when I think you get another wave of deflation. That's my base case. But my point is, I realize that it is unknowable to the point where I wouldn't make an investment decision based on me thinking to myself that I know definitively what is going to happen with inflation over the next year or two. Now, I'm not saying I'm right or wrong or that you should do the same. I'm just expressing my ideas. So you guys can take that, and maybe you can find value in me thinking out loud and how I'm seeing these charts, and then how I'm taking this information and applying it to my own investment decisions. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. As always, make sure that you're standing up for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism, and we'll see you in the next video.